Hello and welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Annie Waters. Hi, Annie.
Hi.
And this week we thought we'd bring you our top books of 2022 so far.
Yep, we've reached the midpoint.
We've reached a midpoint, much despite the fact we're in denial. But so we won't really do book news, but I did want to get Annie's take on the John Hughes drama because Amanda and I talked about this last week. The Miles Franklin long list included The Dogs by John Hughes, and that was then removed from the long list because they found elements of plagiarism in the book.
Mm.
And he's then come out and said, well, this is meant to be a collage, and I'm quite happy to say that, yes, I've referenced Anna Karenina and other Russian...
The Great Gatsby.
And
what
other
haven't I referenced?
Books. But that was just all part of the style and it was artistic license, and I'm really sorry if that's, you know, been misunderstood. It hasn't been great publicity for him, and Amanda and I were just thinking, well, why didn't you acknowledge that? Because we would have thought, not
he
having
also,
read the book,
yeah.
So we don't know how much it was word for word, but we would have thought you would just acknowledge that you've taken those references at the end of the book, and it's embarrassed the publisher. So Terry Ann White has been embarrassed by it because she said she should have pushed him harder to do that. So I think that's what I would think of as standard practice, not knowing the industry
as
well as you
do. I think she didn't
know.
So yeah, Annie, I'm fascinated.
Tell us. First of all, have you read it?
No.
But
and I was
how word for word is
well,
this?
I mean, it just keeps coming out. More and more things keep coming out that he has plagiarized. There's one account on Twitter who has been reading it as the kind of drama has been unfolding, and every paragraph or section that he kind of thinks, oh, that's a bit of a shift in tone, he kind of does a Google, you know, reverse search, and lo and behold, another author has been plagiarized.
Wow.
And it really is word for word. And some of them, I mean, I think the first ones that came out that The Guardian discovered were from Svetlana Alexievich's Nobel Prize winning.
Yeah.
And it's interviews with Holocaust survivors and survivors of that terrible, terrible war. And the title of the book is actually from one of these stories where a woman is telling Alexievich, a person in her community was fleeing from these people who were oppressing them, and she had a young baby that she had to kill because they had scent dogs and the baby would cry and she was afraid for her life. So she killed the baby. That's the title of the book, taken from someone's experience. And he, what gets me is that he has changed his tone. So when the Alexievich accusations came out, he said, oh, look, well, I taught that as a lecturer, and so it must have got mixed up with my notes. And he had also taken extensive interviews with people. But I think if someone told you that in person, that is a life-changing experience. You would never forget that experience. It's a horrifying story to hear in person.
Also, what does that mean, it got mixed up in my notes?
That his notes for the book that he's been writing for 20 years got jumbled together with his lecturing notes, and that he ended up thinking that was one of his interviews that he'd done. But how could you – you would not forget that kind of visceral experience.
No.
So he lied about that. And then when several days later – I know, sorry, it's really full on. Several days later it came out that he'd plagiarized from The Great Gatsby, from
Tolstoy,
Dostoevsky, from all of these – huge names. And then he kind of tried to come up with the clever line, oh, well, you know, no one ever makes anything on their own. A good artist steals.
Yeah.
I was just kind of like, no, you got caught. You got caught, and you are trying so desperately to backpedal. I don't think, so Upswell, which is the publisher, I don't think they knew. And I think Terry Ann White has now come out with a statement being like, I didn't know, and I'm so upset.
Yeah, she's
that.
Well, she must have known something because she said, I should have pushed him harder on the acknowledgements, was part of her statement.
Yeah,
so,
but I think she must not have realised the extent of it. There's having a polite nod to really famous literature, and there's seeing how much you can get away with. And I think this definitely at least falls into that category. If not, he thought he was going to get away with it.
How, though?
I mean, it's been published for 6 months. No one picked it up.
It's very interesting because it goes to, you know, all art, even literature, is referencing or acknowledges, or it might reference in some way what has gone before, even if it's just the structure, you know. But some much more overtly than others.
But even if you were cutting up people's different works and pasting them together, I think you do have to acknowledge that you didn't write that. Maybe you've made this kind of Robert Rauschenberg collage out of other people's cut up bits that you've pushed together.
I think it's just polite to acknowledge it. So you could look at something like Bridget Jones's Diary. Does not copy words.
It's an homage. Yeah.
But it's an homage to Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
And I don't know if she even does mention it, but it wouldn't do any harm to mention I'm indebted to the great Jane Austen or something like
that. Yeah, but it's also not pretending to be anything
else.
It's
not copying, and it's very, very much a modern
take.
A modern story.
Yeah.
It's a modern take, and there have been numerous of them. Mm. There have been numerous modern takes of Shakespeare's stories and so on.
Yeah.
But that's a different thing. This one, I think, has adopted some of the wording, which
is getting into a lot. And I think also you have to use that then as a marketing tool. You know, I can see that there would be a book possible that you could say, look, I've mashed together 20 of the world's greatest books and look what I've made. I've made this whole different story telling all these different narratives, and then it would be almost like a puzzle for people to go through and kind of figure out what goes with what.
Exactly. If that is the style, I think you have to really own it.
Exactly.
And you have to acknowledge it, especially if you've copied over – if you've copied word for word, that's a really specific thing. But as you say, you could actually use it in your marketing because that could be fun.
Yeah, like absolutely.
I might be quite intrigued to read that. But not saying anything at all and then trying to downplay it.
Yeah, or double down and say, well, no, of course I did that deliberately. Who wouldn't have guessed?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's – I don't know whether he believes his own what he's saying or whether he's really just scrabbling for any kind of legitimacy. But it is really tricky because I think it puts publishers in such a difficult moral quandary. The same as someone like all the tiny
James
little
Frey.
James Frey. Yeah. So James Frey, he went to the publishers with his book as fiction and they said, oh, but is this your life story? And he said yes. And it was kind of a bit of a not quite coercion but implication that it would sell better if it was a memoir. And it was based on his life. He had experienced those – he felt like he had experienced a lot of those things, but it was a very subjective memoir and he'd had a lot of interference from drugs and some mental health issues. So when it was published as the legitimate God's own truth, people then had a problem with it. Whereas if it had been published as a fictionalized memoir, I think he wouldn't have faced a lot of the backlash that he faced.
Yeah.
I mean, literary scandals in general just fascinate me because it's like I love a mystery and I love, you know, the psychological
it's quite drama. Rare.
Totally. Well, especially at this level. But it also the amount of anxiety it gives me to imagine making something like that that you know is based on just this quicksand. How do you not think you're going to get caught? That's the thing that fascinates me and baffles me.
I think they must have a different mindset where they think they're entitled to use
those words.
They don't see it as plagiarism.
Yeah.
They see it as just making art out of all these words that are in front of them in old books that they want to use.
Mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sure it'll keep playing out for some time, but I don't think he'll be published again in Australia for quite a while.
Oh, no, no. Well, my favourite one was A.J. Finn, The Woman in the Window.
Oh, yes.
And apart from the fact
that was fascinating.
That does reference lots and lots of well-known movies in particular, but I think he didn't necessarily shy away from that, but then his own personal story and the things he'd said to his employer because he worked for a publisher and the stories he told about, my mother died of cancer and my father's this and my brother. And then it was just one thing after another and none of it was
adding
true.
Up.
It just didn't all quite add up and it just goes to show he's obviously born to make up stories.
Yes.
But
it
was so interesting. When you listen to interviews with him, he's such a smooth, charming talker and you just actually don't know what to believe.
Yeah, where does the line stop between fiction and reality for him especially, you know, like in his brain is that all true and he's all just kind of – or do you just talk and then
you just don't
it becomes
know.
Real, as
and
you say.
Who knows? Now, anyway, on to our – on to our best books of the year. Annie, why don't you kick us
cool.
off?
Cool. Okay.
One of your, we're well, doing about three each.
We are. So off the bat, my top book so far is The Sentence by Louise Erdrich, but I didn't bring it because we've already done a whole episode on it. So I thought you've all heard about how much I love that already.
Well, that was in mine as well.
Yeah, yes. So definitely that's up there for the top book of the year. But something else that I've been enjoying recently, I read this on a plane and I loved it. Oh. I did not expect to love it as much as I did. It won the CWA Dagger recently. It's called Before You Knew My Name by Jacqueline Bublitz or Bublitz. She's Australian and it's set in New York and it's about a young woman who's murdered at 18. She's been in New York for 1 month. She's arrived after quite a rough upbringing and kind of run away from home, come to New York as the big city of, you know, new opportunities, and is getting herself on her feet when after 1 month she is killed. And at the same time as she arrives in New York, a woman comes to America from Sydney, and she has been the woman in an affair for a long time with a man who's about to get married to his partner. She just cannot cope with that anymore, and so she upends her whole life, comes to New York and gets an apartment there, and she finds the body. So they land in New York on the same day, and you kind of track both of their paths as they come closer and closer together. And then when she finds the body, she becomes obsessed with finding out who this girl is because she's a Jane Doe. They don't know who she is. And so she kind of pushes forward the case while everyone else goes about their business and almost forgets who this young woman is. And so it's kind of a whodunit, but I think the more compelling thing about it is that it looks at trauma and how it affects everyone, how we heal from that. And I loved the way that it's told. It's told from both of their perspectives, and the young woman who is murdered is one of the main narrators of the book. So she kind of pushes it forward even past her death. So you know early on that she's going to die, and she's kind of narrating it backwards. Yeah, I loved it. It's a real page turner, but really well written, really slick, and you just love both of these women and want the best for them, even though you know one of them is not going to have a happy ending.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, really good.
So that's Before You Knew My Name by Jacqueline Bublitz.
Mm.
Well, I might have to pick that up because I do have a plane
journey. I brought it just in case you might want to borrow it.
Yes. Thank you.
What's yours?
I have to say, the first half of the year, I haven't had lots and lots of standout reads. So it wasn't as if sometimes at the end of the year I'm really trying to whittle it down to, say, 5 or 10 top books, and I've got too many and I can't choose. But in this case, there haven't been that many that I've really loved. And that might be partly I've been so busy. I haven't actually spent that much time reading and I haven't been very patient with books. But one that we have done an episode on, but I had to mention it, apart from The Sentence, which I agree with you, is The Candy House by Jennifer Egan, because it was such a fun read. I don't know, a bit like you, Annie, I don't know how much I will retain all of the details of the plot points of what happened, but all I remember is loved reading it, love her use of language. It's so lively, it's so propulsive. The sense of humour underlying the whole book is really just keeps a smile on your face. It does explore interesting elements of contemporary society and family dynamics, but it's also just how everyone is different. You know, all the humans in this book, all the characters are very different, and that's reflected in the styles that she uses. So it's just the way she tells their story. She'll use a different format. So one of them memorably is the future, you know, the person who's got the chip inserted in them and they do the field notes. But it's even in the less inventive sort of chapters, there's just a different style because the characters are all really idiosyncratic but really fun. Can't recommend it highly enough. And it does sit with A Visit from the Goon Squad, but I don't think you have to read both of them, and you don't have to read them even in order. I know a lot of people who are reading The Candy House who then think, oh, I must go and read. I never read A Visit from the Goon Squad. I'm going to go back and read that.
It's a little bit like David Mitchell's books where you can read one of them and you can just enjoy it as the story, and then if you read all of them, you'll find characters that reoccur or themes that reoccur that are kind of little Easter egg type moments, and you can put together something in it. But you don't need, it's not required reading.
It's just
an added element, yeah.
Yeah, so loved good one. It. The Candy House.
My next is a cheat because it's a trilogy. I've read two of them so far. So it's Deborah Levy's, I don't know if she has a name for them, about her relationship. So the first is Things I Don't Want to Know, and this one is called The Cost of Living, and then the third one is called Real Estate, and I haven't read that one yet. But I have just inhaled both of the first two so quickly. I actually saved them up after having read the first one in an afternoon, just sitting on the couch with a cup of tea. I saved this until I had a free afternoon and I could just sit down and dive into it, because they're really slim little novels. Well, not novels, slim little biographies, but they are so precise, even as she kind of meanders around an idea or several ideas. So the first one is told in three large sections and really covers her childhood and how she came to this little hotel in Italy on a cold winter's night. She's kind of rocked up. She's stayed there before, but she's come. You suspect that she's leaving her husband, but that's never explicitly said in the book. And she kind of comes to this place to think and be alone and write. And when she gets there, she meets this whole host of characters. All these people are quite strange. And then she starts thinking about her own childhood in South Africa and talks about her parents. And so you kind of get this real grounding of her life. And it is also about, I guess, how to be a writer and a mother and a woman and a wife and all of these different roles that kind of coalesce and really conspire against being able to have good creative output through your main years of life. You know, that her children are kind of just at that teenage point. She is at absolute breaking point dealing with them and her husband and everything. She describes it as, you know, she's on a life raft and she wants to throw herself into the water.
Is this in The Cost of Living?
That's in The Cost of Living. Yeah. So, and then,
I'd love to read that. I did love Real Estate.
That's Things I Don't Want to Know.
Things I Don't Want to Know.
Yeah, so in that one she's really facing away from her problems. This one, which is called The Cost of Living, she tackles it much more head on. So this one she talks in much shorter essays, I guess, or chapters about creativity and writing and the craft of writing, which I love. So, yeah, anyone who loves Elena Ferrante or Rachel Cusk, someone like that, Sigrid Nunez, who's got really clearly thought out precise ideas about writing, but that are expressed through these perfect scenes that kind of just encapsulate. It's almost like, how can reality give you such a perfect peach of a scene to encapsulate the idea that you want to express? But it's just because she takes such good notes and she sees the world in a way that I really don't. You know, I breeze through the world, whereas she just has such a clear eye on everything that's going around her. And probably that's to her detriment in some ways, that she can't not think about everything through this writer's eye, but it all becomes fodder for the journals, you know.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a couple of things. One, Charlotte Wood's The Luminous Solution about creativity, which is also really cleanly written and super intelligent but accessible, gorgeous, gorgeous writing. If you're into the Deborah Levy books, I think you'd love Christos Tsolkas' 7.5, which is again merging that what is involved in being a writer but in a fictional way that makes it like a scene by scene. But I'm also thinking of, I haven't read this, but Helen Garner's diaries, which apparently she talks about, and I don't think she does name him, but she had been married to Murray Bale, who was an Australian author of some renown. And it sounded, what I have heard about the diaries sounded like it was very difficult to be married to him. He needed complete silence in the house so that he could write. And it very much, his career was the ego, the focus, enormous, the ego and all of that. And then you think about, but it's Helen Garner, who's the queen, you know, and imagining her having to deal with that. So it's really fascinating when you get a different side of a marriage, the struggle to have that room of one's own or that independence to write.
Yeah, so in this one she kind of has to move out and get her own flat, and then she keeps the children because she's the woman. So then she still has to find her own place to write, and she ends up, this eccentric woman that she knows lets her use her little back garden shed in the middle of winter. So again, she's freezing cold. She has to rig up all of these eccentric ways to keep herself warm, but she loves it. It's her, you know,
it's her space.
It's such a pleasure to have her own space and her own time to think. So yeah, I loved this. this. I can't wait to read Real Estate. I highly recommend the trilogy.
Well, I think Amanda and I did Real Estate on the podcast. Oh, we loved it.
I haven't listened to that one.
Loved it. So that one was The Cost of Living by Deborah Levy. Yeah. But there are the...
There's three in total.
Things I Don't Want to Know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Real Estate. I feel like I'm not being very original. We have done this on the podcast as well, but this is Devotion by Hannah Kent. So both Devotion and The Candy House and indeed The Sentence, they're all books that I've just completely been immersed in and swept away by and that lovely feeling when you finally get to a novel that you think, I'm in the story. Don't disturb me. Can't wait to get back to it. I want to know what happens. I'm just so engrossed with the characters. Loved it. So this is the German settlement in South Australia. So you start in Prussia in the 1830s, I think, from memory, and you've got the main character, I want to say Hannah, and she has a really beautiful, deep friendship and it's romantic with another girl whose name I can't find.
Taya.
And they go on the ship to Australia and they end up settling in South Australia in, I think it's in what is now Harndorf in the Adelaide Hills. And so you have first sort of section in Prussia and then the ship and then the section in South Australia. And it's really beautiful. Mm. There is a change sort of halfway through the book. I think it's described as a hinge. Without spoiling anything, it takes a slightly different tone, I suppose. But I absolutely loved it. And that did really grab me and sort of left me physically affected. It felt like a gut punch in a good way, in the sense that I was so into the story that I sort of physically reacted to some of the events that happened, which we won't spoil. And I went with it. So there are some, I don't even want to say supernatural, but there are some quite mystical elements in the later stages of the book, which I was happy to go along with.
Yeah.
Normally I wouldn't be, as we know.
I agree.
And there are ghosts in The Sentence as well. So I don't know what's happening this year with books.
I think if they're well enough written, you know, you can get away with ghosts.
You can go with it. Yeah. Yeah. So you loved this too.
I did. Yeah. I absolutely inhaled it. And I agree. If someone had told me that there was that twist halfway through, if they'd told me what the twist was, I think I would have been like, oh, I don't know how I feel about that. But I knew nothing going in and I loved it with all of my heart.
And her language, her sentence. Sentences.
Exquisite.
Oh.
And just the landscape of Prussia that she imagined and the landscape of this country that she imagined that no longer exists in that form, it just takes you there. And I think that's such an art to be able to both do the imagining and then put it on the page, like Christos Tsolkas again.
Yeah.
There's something really special in that ability to be able to put down what's in your head so clearly onto the page, because I think lots of people try to do that. They have the imagination, but they can't take you there with them. Mm. And she really does that.
And I wonder what she'll do next, because
So
Hannah Kent wrote Burial Rites, which
space
was
drama.
Iceland. I know. So Iceland in the 1300s or so, I want to say, and the Good People Ireland in the
1800s
and now Devotion, so early 1800s. So what will be next? Will it be historical, I wonder?
Yeah, I don't know. I was just listening to an interview with her in the car of a new podcast that I've started listening to called Sundoku, which is by some Adelaide radio personalities, including Kath Keneally. They were talking to her. Yeah, she said that she never set out to write historical novels, but she just gets fascinated by these characters and wants to flesh them out and then starts doing research and goes from there. So who knows?
Oh, fantastic. Mm. What have you got next, Annie?
So my last one and probably my favourite book of the year so far, even though it's not out yet, but hopefully when this episode comes out, it'll be nearly due. So it's coming in the middle of July. It's called Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin. She was born in New York and she has a Korean mum and an Eastern European Jewish dad, and they both worked in computers. And this book is a book about video games and about two young people who meet in hospital. The young girl is there because her sister has leukemia, and so she's spending a lot of time there. And the young boy has been in a terrible car accident and really damaged his one leg, and he's doing lots of surgeries to try and save his foot and his lower leg. And they spend a lot of time playing video games in the, I guess, late 80s, early 90s. So kind of Nintendo 64.
Our time.
Exactly. So it feels real really like a Gen X, millennial, early millennial kind of book. So they form this really close bond over video games, but the friendship fractures. And when we meet them again, they're in college basically. They're both super intelligent, quite strange people. He approaches her and wants to make a video game together, and they end up starting a company. They make these video games. And I know you hate art in books,
yes,
but each of the games that they make, I want to play them so badly. And I think, oh, what I love about it is it's all about illness and power in friendships, and the way that I guess friendships between genders can often be fraught, the way that your childhood kind of shapes where you end up, and the ways that you can kind of hold on to grudges that you perhaps don't deserve to. There's so much in it. I just loved the characters. It follows them over probably about 30 years of their life, and I really, really enjoyed it.
I'm very intrigued.
Mm.
The cover's very fun. It's got computer style writing, but and very 80s looking writing. But also, is that a Japanese wave?
Yes,
picture?
It is. Okay. It is. And that references one of the games that they make.
Of course.
Mm. Mm. Loved it. What's your final one?
This is a book that has stayed with me. Mm. It's not necessarily my best book of the year, but I think it's strong.
Mm.
Son of Sin by Omar Sacker. So mm-hmm. This is a semi-autobiographical book. Omar Sacker's a queer young Muslim writer who's from Western Sydney, lives in Western Sydney, and his parents were, I think, Turkish and Lebanese, mm-hmm. Which is the same as Jamal, the main character of Son of Sin. It's really about Jamal's story and his upbringing and childhood, teenage years, and then young adulthood. And what I loved about this is, I guess, three things. One, the language is really strong.
He's a poet as well.
He's better known for his poetry. This is his first novel. The language is really muscular and strong and moves you forward. The second thing is it's such a slice of life of Western Sydney, so you get a real insight into it. You feel like you're there and just living in that world, in those sort of families, quite strict families, some of them quite religious. So it's really difficult for Jamal to be queer. So there's a lot of repression in that sense, but they're also very loving families in their own way, you know, all going through stuff. It's, if nothing else, very real, very authentic. The other thing that I think that sort of stuck with me is Jamal is just such a real character, and it's obviously very well observed from based on real lived experience, but he's, you know, he's flawed, he's not perfect, he makes interesting decisions, he doesn't, you know, you don't always agree with his choices, but it just sort of stayed with me. And I think then reading a couple of other books which were just a bit more contrived or
not as well written.
Yeah. I just thought, actually, you know, Son of Sin is sort of standing up amongst all of the other books. So I just think it's certainly Omar Sacker's one to watch.
Yeah.
And this one really took me to that place.
I'll have to go back to it. I started it and I was enjoying it, and I can't remember why I put it down.
But
I
made it episodic, so there's not a huge narrative drive in the sense of a story, but that is also explained by Jamal, by him saying because of having quite a traumatic sort of childhood, he doesn't remember his life in a chronological way like other people do. So that partly explains why it's just snippets of, you know, there's an episode from age 15 and then we jump to 19. But it does cohere.
Yeah,
it does sort
I have
of
to
hold
go back
together.
Because, to I love the cover. And the cover is hot pink with this really sexy looking snake on it.
It's a good cover.
Yeah, and Omar, I've heard him read poetry before and he's an incredible speaker. He's really impassioned and his poetry is often, I don't know, he's one of those people who doesn't necessarily match his physical body and the words that he writes. Kind of, you wouldn't put those words with that person automatically. Mm. And it's really beautiful to kind of see him perform that.
I think if you like Christos Tsolkas, you'll like
he was the immediate comparison
quite
for
robust.
Me too. Yeah. Really visceral.
There's
a lot of
language.
Yeah.
And it reminded me a little bit as well of Garth Greenwell. Just
I haven't read him.
In the honesty.
Mm.
And Ocean Vuong.
Mm-hmm.
on Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, that you're getting an insight into someone's life. So quite beautiful. And I'm not always into the autofiction, if that's what it is, as we know, but quite a memorable book.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Great.
So there we are. But we're only halfway through the year.
No, I know. There's so much more to come.
I think there's a lot to come.
Yeah. But it is often funny how I find myself struck by one, like the sentence I read maybe in the first month or two of the year, and it stayed with me. And often that's the way that I'll find one that I'm kind of like, this is my favourite for so long. Well, and it takes a lot to knock it off the perch.
Should it have won the Women's Prize?
No, I'm struggling to think what the did book win. Of oh, yes, emptiness. Which I disliked. So, yes, it should have won. Sorry, there Ruth Ezeki. I love her so much. I've loved every one of her other novels. But I just didn't get along with The Book of Form and Emptiness. I don't see the appeal. I don't know. Anyway. I think that The Island of Missing Trees really should have won. That's probably my pick for that. Yes. But that was such a good novel.
Oh, well, controversy here.
We'll have to start our own prize. With thousands of pounds of prize money.
Exactly. Well, I think it's all about the prize money. Yeah. Yes. Well, let us know what you have been reading. What are your top picks of the year so far? We'd love to hear from you at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go, and I'm on Instagram, Twitter and Litzy at A Bailey Karras. And Annie?
And I'm on Instagram, Litzy and Twitter at Mr_Annie. And we should probably just flag that we're going to have a little hiatus because Anna's going off on holiday.
Yes, we're having we're having a holiday.
Yes, so we'll be back in a month or so with new episodes.
Yes, and I'm going to catch up while I'm away. I'm catching up with Kate at the Book Club Review podcast. So stay tuned for that one as well.
Yeah,
we're
fantastic.
Reading a novel by Simone de Beauvoir.
Oh, the new one?
The Intimacy.
Oh, The Inseparable. Yeah,
have to let me know how it goes. Introduced by
Ali Smith.
Deborah Levy.
Great.
Annie,
it's all
Annie
coming
immediately
together.
Immediately has to go and buy it.
It does look beautiful. It's just come out in paperback.
It's very good. All right. Well, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Bye for now.
Bye.